The test is in four parts, part 1, part 2, part 3, and part 4. Now look at part 1.
Part 1.
You will hear a man talking to a receptionist at a hotel. First, you have some time to look at questions 1 to 7. Listen carefully to the first part of the conversation and answer questions 1 to 7.
Good evening, sir. Do you have a reservation?
Yes. Let me just check I've got everything. Sorry. Yes, a reservation. It's in the name of Hartley, Martin Hartley.
Let me see. Oh, yes. Here it is. That's for 3 nights.
Yes, that's right. Do you need my passport?
I just need to take the number as a form of ID.
No problem.
Now, can I just ask you to fill in this registration form, please?
Ah, actually, no. You see, I've broken my wrist.
Yes, I noticed that.
I'm afraid form filling is something I can't manage right now. Not without a lot of pain, anyway.
Oh, dear. I'm sorry, sir. But don't worry. I can complete the form for you.
That's very kind of you. What do you need to know?
Well, let's start with your name, of course. So that's Martin,
Hartley. That's H-A-R-T-L-E-Y.
Thanks. And your address?
45 Carlisle Way.
Could you spell Carlisle for me? Sorry.
It's C-A-R-L-I-S-L-E. You don't pronounce the S. Carlisle Way. And that's in Lewes. L-E-W-E-S.
And is there a state? I don't think you have states in the UK.
No, we have counties. It's East Sussex. Sussex is with double S. The postcode is LW46AU. Do you want my phone number?
Actually, no. We contact people by email now.
Ah, yes. And send me lots of advertising too, I suppose. My email is hartleynightram@yahoo.co.uk.
Sorry, a bit slower, please.
Hartley, my surname, then Martin backwards, N-I-T-R-A-M. That's all one word.
And all lowercase?
That's right. No capitals. At yahoo.co.uk.
Thank you very much, Mr. Hartley. And could you give me your passport now, please? Thanks. You can have that back now.
Ah.
And that's for 3 nights, so checking out on Sunday morning?
Uh-huh.
Okay. You're in room 16. That's on the first floor, overlooking the courtyard. Here's your key. Would you like somebody to take your bag?
Now you have some time to look at questions 8 to 10. Now listen to the next part of the conversation and answer questions 8 to 10.
Do you have a map I can take?
Yes, of course. We've usually got lots of them here. Somewhere. Ah, yes. Here we are.
Thanks. Could you show me where we are, exactly?
Let me have a look. Yes. This is our street here, Avenida Constitución. The bigger hotels are marked, so let me just see which one is us. Here. Yes, here. This is Hotel Columbus, just before you get to the museum. I say just before because that's the way most people get here. I mean, coming from the main square where all the buses stop, or from the station.
Yes, that's the way the taxi came in from the airport. I thought we drove past the museum, though, just after we went through that big square you mentioned.
Ah, you probably mean here. That's actually an art gallery. It's worth having a look round, but the museum's more interesting. I think so, anyway.
Thanks for the tip. I hope I get time. Right, well, tomorrow I've got to be at the conference centre. They told me they'd put me in a hotel that wasn't too far away.
Oh, yes. The conference centre's not too far at all. Let me see. Yes, down here. You can walk there in 7 or 8 minutes. Just cross over the road and go straight down this street here. That will take you towards the newer part of the city. Walk on for a couple of blocks, and then when you get here, you just have to go right a very short distance, and then you'll see the conference centre above the other buildings. It's quite big.
I see. That all looks quite straightforward. Thanks very much.
My pleasure. Have a nice evening, sir.
That is the end of part one.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part two.
Part two.
You will hear a man talking about a parliament building. First, you have some time to look at questions 11 to 17. Listen carefully to the first part of the talk and answer questions 11 to 17.
Good morning, everyone. Can you all see and hear me? Good. Now, my name's Dan, and I'm your guide this morning for our tour of the New Zealand Parliament. Now, we're standing in the executive wing of the Parliament complex. This is where all the government ministers have their offices and where the Prime Minister and the Cabinet meet. Now, most people here refer to this building as the Beehive, and no prizes for guessing why it's called the Beehive. That's right. It's shaped exactly like a traditional beehive, and it's one of the most famous buildings in Wellington. Now, I'll start with some background information about the design and construction of the building. It may come as a surprise for you to learn that the architect wasn't a New Zealander. No. In fact, it was designed by a Scottish architect, Sir Basil Spence. He designed the concept for the building during a visit he made to our city in 1964. His idea was that all the offices and rooms would radiate from a central core. Now, the Beehive was built in stages over 10 years. Construction began on building the underground car park and the basement at the end of the 1960s, in 1969. And over the next decade, the remaining floors were constructed. Yes, one decade later, in 1979, the first parliamentary offices moved in. Now, as you can see, the beehive is pretty high. In fact, it's 72 metres tall. It has 10 floors above ground and an additional 4 floors below. So that's a total of 14 floors altogether. That means there's plenty of space for the many facilities available to the members of Parliament and ministers to use. These include a small theatre and a television studio. Now, if you'd all just like to follow me, we can make our way inside the building itself.
Now you have some time to look at questions 18 to 20. Now listen to the rest of the talk and answer questions 18 to 20.
Here we are in the entrance foyer. It's a very airy space, isn't it? And if you look at the floor you're standing on, you'll see it's made of marble. And if you look to your left, you can see some beautiful columns. They are also made from marble. Now, look at the wall panels. They are made of stainless steel. They look really stunning, don't they? Now, straight ahead of us is the staircase leading to the first floor of the building. As you can see, the railings on the staircase are made of bronze. Now, let's make our way up this beautiful staircase to the banquet hall on the first floor, and we can admire these beautiful bronze railings on the way. So this is the banquet hall. And as you can see, it's shaped in the form of a semicircle. It's also a pretty big space, isn't it? It's actually a big enough dining room to hold up to 300 guests. Now look at the large mural to your right. It's three-dimensional and shows the atmosphere and sky of New Zealand. And the floor we're standing on is made of wood. It's a native New Zealand timber called tawa. Okay, now let's make our way to the...
That is the end of part two.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part three.
Part three.
You will hear three students talking about how to spend their time before going to university.
First, you have some time to look at questions 21 to 25. Now, listen carefully and answer questions 21 to 25.
What's that you're reading, Matt?
Oh, hi, Tara. It's an article about taking a gap year before going to university.
Is that what you're thinking of doing, then?
Well, I hadn't really considered it as an option, but reading this has got me thinking. I'm looking forward to starting at uni, but I wouldn't mind a bit of time to myself first.
Hi, guys.
What are you talking about?
Hi, Sandy.
How's it going?
Matt's reading about gap years. He wants to put off going to uni.
I think a gap year's a great idea. I'm definitely thinking about it.
Are you? What would you do with the year?
Well, the programmes I've looked at involve volunteering of some kind. I wouldn't want to just go travelling for a year. I couldn't afford that anyway. The idea would be to work and help people, but
more importantly, to grow up and come back knowing more about the world than I do now. Obviously, I'd choose somewhere hot and sunny.
So, what exactly is volunteering? I mean, OK, I understand it means doing something for nothing, but what does it mean in terms of a gap year?
Yeah, it means working with programmes in countries where people need support or some kind of aid.
I bet your mum and dad aren't quite as enthusiastic as you are about all this.
On the contrary, they're really supportive. They can see all the pluses. They realise that I don't know exactly where I want to be in 10 years' time. They think it'll give me time to figure things out and not make decisions I might regret later.
I think I'd be worried about how the university look at it, though. Don't you think it suggests you're just putting off studying?
Definitely not. Our tutor told us that a lot of universities encourage students to take a gap year. They see a year away growing up and maturing as an asset. Students arrive in higher education with an extra year of life experience, depending on what you do with the time, obviously.
Yes, I can see that tutors might like having a few well-travelled students around. I mean, ones that have a more developed perspective.
I think they also appreciate that students who come back from a year away, doing something worthwhile, have a stronger sense of direction and a clearer idea of what they hope to achieve. They probably speak at least a few words of another language too. The most important thing for the unis is that students are motivated.
So anyway, what does your article say about the options? Do they suggest where students should go on their gap year?
You now have some time to look at questions 26 to 30.
Now listen to the rest of the discussion and answer questions 26 to 30.
Well, apparently, Australia's the country where the highest percentage of students take a gap year, and it's the most popular destination for gap year students from other countries as well as Britain.
I like the sound of a year in Australia.
They say here that there are three main attractions. The abundance of Great Coast, beautiful beaches, learn to surf, all that stuff. Then there's the amount of time you can spend enjoying outdoor activities, like hiking and loads of sports. And thirdly, the cosmopolitan cities, especially Sydney, which apparently is awesome. It's a great country for young people because there's so much to do. Loads of adventure and sunshine, obviously.
Sounds good to me.
Unfortunately, it says here the cost of getting there in the first place can be prohibitive. However you make your way there, it's expensive. Unless the bank of mum and dad help out, that is. Then, look, they also mention various places in Africa, but they single out Ghana. Students can get involved with the construction of new schools or teaching the kids that are already in them.
That does sound really rewarding and interesting, I have to say. I guess there's a huge sense of achievement with something like that, and you get fantastic life experience from living in another culture.
I think you pick up some real practical skills too, skills you can bring back with you.
Another place I really like the sound of is Nepal.
What's the attraction there?
Most of the volunteering involves teaching again, and it's that sense of achievement that people are after. They also say, let me read it, students are attracted by the simplicity of daily existence. I think they mean you have to spend a year without your computer and all the rest of it. It's all about going back to basics.
So where do people stay?
They live on farms or in mountain retreats.
I'm not so sure I could manage that. I don't mind hard work, but I like a hot shower at the end of the day.
Yeah, I imagine the food's not great either.
They do actually say here that one of the things volunteers miss is good food choices. Anyway, there are plenty of other options. Why don't you read the rest of the...
That is the end of part three.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.
Now turns to part four.
Part four.
You will hear a woman talking about retail psychology. First, you have some time to look at questions 31 to 40. Listen carefully to the talk and answer questions 31 to 40.
Hello, everyone. Let's get started on the final lecture in our module on retail psychology. Today, we're going to focus on supermarket layouts and how retailers display their products to encourage us as customers to spend as much of our money as possible. It's an interesting topic. Now, most of us don't actually realise that the layout is deliberately designed to make us part with our money. But in fact, millions of pounds are spent on research into the psychology of shoppers and what motivates us to buy. So, let's have a look at an actual supermarket layout. Now, here's the entrance to the store, just here. This area immediately around the entrance is what retailers refer to as the decompression zone or the dead zone. This is where the customers recover from the environment outside. And by that I mean this is where they adjust. For example, the place where they might put their keys in their pockets or take off their sunglasses, these kinds of things. So, what do you notice about this area? It's very empty, isn't it? Yes, it's pretty much clear of stock altogether. This area is not designed or used to sell us anything. Basically, the supermarkets never put any merchandise here because they know that no one's ready to buy yet. However, the retailers want their customers to feel comfortable. If they're in a relaxed state of mind, they're much more likely to stay longer and spend money. Now, let's look back at the entrance again. Now, it's interesting, but we know that three-quarters of us look right, not left, when we go into a supermarket. So, 75% of people. This gives the supermarkets a great opportunity to hit us with promotions and offers. So, near the front door, you might also find what we call the dwell zone. The dwell zone is the area on the right-hand side by the front door where you are encouraged to relax and browse. You will usually find newspapers and flowers here to help you do exactly that. Moving on from the dwell zone, we come to the power aisle. Basically, it's the main route customers return to after venturing into nearby aisles. And so this is the area of the supermarket where the strongest offers are displayed. So you might see a sign that reads barbecue time, and you'll see all the items you could possibly need for a barbecue. The charcoal, the sauces, the skewers and the drinks, everything you need all in one place.
Were you planning a barbecue before you went shopping? Do you even have a garden? Yes, the power aisle has a very powerful effect on sales, even though most of us don't even realize we are being sold to here. Now, let's think about fruit and vegetables for a moment. They're always located towards the front. Now, why do you think this is? Yes, fruit and vegetables are always at the front because it gives the supermarket a healthy image. And let's think back to flowers and newspapers. We talked about both these items earlier. And yes, they're displayed near the front on the right. Now, they're known as distress goods. Why is that? Well, these are the goods that we often buy in a hurry or on impulse. In other words, these are the items we didn't actually intend to buy at all. But the supermarkets want us to put them in our trolleys even before we start our proper shopping. Now, what about everyday items like bread or milk or cereals? They're always placed right at the back of the supermarket. Yes, in this area here. Again, this is a deliberate strategy by the supermarkets. Basically, they want us to walk through the whole store to get them in the hope we will buy other things on the way. That's why items like these are often called destination goods. Now, where products are placed on the shelves makes a real difference. We read shelves a bit like we read a book. Our eyes go from left to right. And they want you to focus on the more expensive items, so they place them at eye level. It's often quite hard to spot items like cheap tinned food. Why is that? Well, they're normally placed very low on the shelves. Basically, the supermarkets don't want the cheapest products to be the ones you see first. Finally, let's have a look at the checkout area here. Now, we all know that sweets are deliberately placed within the reach of children at the checkout. But all kinds of things are displayed at checkouts these days. In fact, supermarkets can change what's on offer almost by the hour. It's a quick and easy way for them to rotate their stock. So, if the sun comes out, the checkout is an ideal place to display sunglasses. And if it rains, umbrellas can be placed there instead. Now, does anyone have any questions?
That is the end of part four.
You now have half a minute to check your answers.